Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Coming up on today's program, a preview of a fascinating documentary airing tonight on PBS called Murder of a President, focusing on President James Garfield. At the end of the hour, a conversation about resilience. A quick note about tomorrow's morning show. We're actually giving our experts on politics, Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg, a day to sort of digest last night's results in the Iowa caucus and ongoing conversation across the country about those results. So they are joining us live in the studios tomorrow to offer their analysis of this presidential campaign thus far and what is likely ahead. So be sure to be listening to tomorrow's morning show. Thursday, a preview of a world premiere at Carthage College this coming weekend, a brand new opera called Black September in a double bill with Puccini's Sur Angelica. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. I always count it a special pleasure and privilege when I get to examine an American Experience documentary ahead of when it airs for the rest of you. And American Experience always does such a superb job of telling important stories from our own history. And it's especially interesting when American Experience, in a sense, uncovers a fascinating and important story that the rest of us don't even realize is as important as it is, or as fascinating as, in fact, it is. That is exactly the case with a remarkable film airing tonight on PBS's American Experience, on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. The film is called Murder of a President. It examines what is probably the least discussed of any presidential assassination, that of James Garfield in 1881. It turns out to be quite a fascinating story and a very troubling one as well. In fact, there is sort of a hidden double meaning in the title of this documentary, which we will be talking about, along with other intriguing details about this story, which so few of us know enough about. I'm speaking today on the morning show with Rob Rapley, who is both director and producer of this remarkable film. You have enjoyed his work, I'm sure, in previous American Experience documentaries, including his program on Wyatt Earp, and a series of documentaries on the abolitionists. Again, this film airing tonight is called Murder of a President. And Rob Rapley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I want to just mention, I'm not even certain our listeners will hear it or you, Mr. Rapley, but we have major construction work going on in the building. So from time to time, there may be the slight intrusion of background noise, which I'm hearing very loudly. I hope it's not too much of a distraction in the conversation we're about to have.
No, it gives you some credibility. It sounds like you're in a war zone.
There you go. So let's talk about this incredible story, which so few of us know much about, because so few of us know very much at all about President James Garfield. Even those of us who can rattle off all of the presidents in order, as I can, I have to confess to knowing very, very little about him or the circumstances that surrounded his death. When did this remarkable story first present itself to you?
Well, Garfield really did languish in obscurity for, well, almost, you know, from the late 19th century until a few years ago, when Candace Millard wrote a wonderful book called Destiny of the Republic. And she really rescued Garfield from obscurity. He was president for such a short time that he really his story kind of disappeared very quickly, and it's one of the tragic aspects that people at the time knew that he would be forgotten, and that they were very it was one of the aspects of the tragedy that they knew at the time that he would disappear. So The book came to my attention a couple of years ago, and at American Experience, we decided that it would make a wonderful film.
That it does. I think one of the things your film does, and I appreciate that you take the time to do this, is that we get a sense of historical context. That is what crucial years these were. We are not even two decades out of the Civil War, and America is still very much trying to knit itself back together.
And I'm sorry to interrupt. It's especially, I think, important in this period because we can assume no knowledge. You know, we know that Abraham Lincoln was shot in 1865, and we know that Teddy Roosevelt is elected, and there's all this gray area in between. But in fact, this period, 1880, 1881, was really a pivot point in the nation's history, and it's something that's lost. So we did make an effort to kind of lay out, this is the point where, in a way, the Civil War really ends, and the next era, and unfortunately, the Jim Crow era, really begins, and this is the pivot point at which that changes.
Right. And, of course, they are crucial years in which, of course, we have President Andrew Johnson, the infamous Andrew Johnson that succeeds Lincoln on his assassination, President Grant, who does his best but who struggles with the challenges of the office, and then a president who is elected under very much contested circumstances, Rutherford B. Hayes, one of the closest elections and most controversial in our history. In 1881, at last comes what seems to be a shining moment of promise with the election of James Garfield, one of the most ably equipped men to ever be elected president. Tell our listeners something about his background, which ultimately made him so qualified for the challenges which any president at that point in time would be facing.
Well, he was the last of the log cabin presidents. He really did grow up dirt poor. His father died before his second birthday, and his mother, they were plunged into poverty, and his mother had to, was out in the fields working within a few days of his death. He seemed to be destined for a life of obscurity in central, working on a farm in central Ohio. And his mother gave him her life savings, $17, and that was enough for one term of school. And it turned out that he was brilliant, and he quickly distinguished himself and managed to rise above those origins, started a little career in politics. And just as he was getting going, the Civil War broke out, and he distinguished himself in the war. He rose to the rank of general, and in 1864 entered the House of Congress, where he was an ardent supporter of Abraham Lincoln, and became a radical Republican. One very interesting story. He was in Congress. So he was in Congress for a long time. He's first elected in 1864. And our story unfolds in 1880-81. So he's in Congress that whole time, and he rises to be the equivalent of the House leader for the Republicans. And what happens after the election of Rutherford B. Hayes is all of the kind of post-Civil War efforts to enfranchise black men are done with. That ends, and so we have a wave of not neo-Confederates, not ex-Confederates, but Confederates elected to Congress as a result of that. But the black men can't vote anymore. So as a result, there's a huge wave of violence and intimidation, and which results in the election of these Confederates. It's the first time since the Civil War that the Democrats have a majority in the House. And Garfield, as the Republican leader, is trying to fight a kind of rearguard action against this Confederate movement. And that you have one of these Democratic ex-Confederate officers saying, in the New York Times, like, we should never have left in 18 60, 61, because now we're getting everything we wanted just in the house, you know, by this means. And so Garfield sees everything that they had fought for, everything that all the gains of the Civil War, everything that Lincoln had wanted, kind of threatened. And that's the context in which he rises to some measure of national prominence as kind of the torchbearer for that Lincoln vision of America. So that kind of sets up the election the next year.
Hmm. Some of what you're talking about brings to mind the brilliant campaign speech which he delivered in August of 1880. Hmm. Really the only major campaign speech he delivered in that campaign, when he says at one point, "Gentlemen," as he's speaking to his fellow veterans, a group of fellow veterans, "Gentlemen, ideas outlive men. Ideas outlive all earthly things. You who fought in the war for the Union fought for immortal ideas, and by their might you crowned the war with victory. But victory was worth nothing except for the truths that were under it, in it, and above it. We meet tonight as comrades to stand guard around the sacred truths for which we fought." This is someone who can is, in a sense, uniquely able to speak about such matters, having tasted war firsthand.
Exactly. He was a wonderful speaker. That speech is a wonderful moment, and I think it remarkable because the trend, of course, in the United States at that time was a reconciliation between North and South, but that reconciliation was coming at the expense of black people. That you know, essentially the deal was Northerners would throw over black people and everybody would be friends again. And Garfield ardently wanted reconciliation, but he was not prepared to countenance the abuse of, you know, the abandonment of black people to that end. And so in those days, as you mentioned, presidential candidates didn't appear very often. In fact, it was unusual for him to give even one speech, but he does give this one brilliant speech in New York. And, you know, when you read the other speeches that were given that night, because, of course, in those days you'd have 8 hours of you know, one speaker after another. Nobody else is talking about race. Everybody else is talking about this or that. But Garfield is really flying in the face of a national trend. There isn't a lot of political capital in standing up for black people in 1880. And he's really doing this out of principle in the only speech that he gives. So this is his one chance to really lay down what he believes in. And he does so brilliantly. And you know, as I say, he's kind of fighting a national trend for no real political benefit, but what he's really searching for is reconciliation without giving up
right.
the gains of the Civil War.
And he shows such courage. I'll read one other portion of it, which speaks directly to what you're saying, as he quotes a poet saying, "For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition." And it did gentle the condition and elevate the heart of every worthy soldier who fought for the Union. "And he shall be our brother forevermore. Another thing we will remember. We will remember our allies who fought with us. Soon after the great struggle began, we looked behind the army of white rebels and saw 4 million of black people condemned to toil as slaves for our enemies. And we found that the hearts of these 4 million were God-inspired with the spirit of liberty, and that they all were our friends. We have seen the white men betray the flag and fight to kill the Union, but in all that long, dreary war, we never saw a traitor in a black skin." He goes on to speak with even more eloquence from there, but this speaks to the courage with which James Garfield, future President James Garfield, was speaking something which was not an easy matter to address. And in fact, he probably could have been seen as imperiling any future political aspirations by being so bold.
Absolutely. He really was laying down a marker, and everybody knew it was going to be a very close election, and he threw caution to the winds and stood on principle.
Hmm. We're speaking with Rob Rapley, who is the director and producer of a marvelous film called Murder of a President, which examines the life and career of James Garfield and his presidency cut tragically short. One thing we should mention is that, particularly once we get to that point of the actual assassination, we come to hear more and more about Mrs. Garfield, Lucrezia Garfield. And one thing that is mentioned in your film that I, for one, never knew was this sort of checkered history of their marriage. And it's so remarkable because I think, on the one hand, we sort of objectively know that such things occurred in the 19th century and every century. And yet somehow when we look at those black and white old photographs of past presidents, we don't think about this kind of human frailty, human failing, being part of their stories. We associate that with our own day. Can you just say a word about what I'm talking about and the care that you evidently took to tell this part of the Garfield story as sensitively as you did?
It's a fascinating aspect of the story that, it's rather ugly in a way, that when they started courting quite young, as people did in those days as teenagers, and they were very attracted to each other, but they had very different natures. And their courtship was very difficult. Garfield was, just off gallivanting around, and Lucretia was very shy, and they were fundamentally attracted because they were both brilliant. But they eventually their courtship goes on long enough that they kind of have to get married or give it up, and they decide to get married, and they have these terrible fights, and he goes off, and their first child, the birth of their first child, brings them together. But that child, as so often happened in those days, died at the age of 2 or 3. And, you know, a few weeks after that, Garfield goes and cheats on Lucretia. He goes off to New York, and he has an affair with some woman. And he comes back, and he confesses. And oddly enough, that's really when their relationship takes hold, that they somehow, whatever had to be worked out is worked out in this moment. And what happens is that they really begin to fall in love. And within a few years, the tone of their letters changes completely. And he is just completely smitten with her and remains so to the end. It's a very endearing love story, and it's very human, and you know, something that actually, you know, does sound real to us, and I think happened then just as often as it does now. But one of the remarkable things about it is that we only know this, all of this stuff, because Lucretia Garfield kept all those letters. You know, he died young, and she survived him by several decades, and she kept everything. You know, and so we only know that he cheated on her. We only know that they had, you know, kind of a difficult life in bed for a while and so on. And we only know that because she kept everything. And it speaks to her faith in him that she trusted that the better we knew him, the more we would like him. Because in those days, of course, the standard thing was to destroy anything damaging, which is one of the reasons we have such anodyne pictures of many of these people. But she trusted us, she trusted him, and she trusted us as well with this most, you know, painful information, the most painful episodes of their lives together. She entrusted it to us, so we felt a responsibility to handle it as if she were a dear friend who had entrusted us with this information. Mm. And, sorry, go.
I think you did exactly that. I mean, I think the matter was handled beautifully, and I am so glad that this is part of the story that you tell, because it's amazing to me how James Garfield becomes this vibrant human being in a way that the vast majority of 19th century presidents cannot possibly be. I mean, we just cannot feel that same sort of, in a sense, emotional resonance that we can with Garfield and a tiny handful of others, where, in a sense, a more complete personal portrait has been left for posterity to examine.
That's right. And, you know, for example, Chester Arthur, Garfield's successor, just burned everything just shortly before he died. Everything. So, you know, we really just don't know him very well, except, you know, what records other people left of him. But we are privileged to know Garfield almost as well as if he were a close friend or brother.
We're speaking with Rob Rapley, director and producer of this film called Murder of a President. And, of course, we've not yet even entered into the, in a sense, central story of your film. But I hope we've really managed to convey to our listeners that this film is about so much more than that assassin's bullet. And I so appreciate the fact that the context is so richly textured. There are several matters about the shooting of President Garfield that are important to acknowledge. And we should also say that your film theatrically or dramatically recreates that incident and most of the others that are talked about in the film. Talk for a moment about the kind of scant protection which a president was given in those days, even what was just a few years after the assassination of President Lincoln.
That's right. You know, 16 years after the Lincoln assassination, you would think that somebody would have said, well, you know, why don't we not let everybody walk in off the street into the president's office and, you know, or into the White House receptions and so on. But that was exactly the case. That you had, it was considered really an essential part of our democracy that the public should have complete unfettered access to the president himself. And as a result, office seekers in particular, it was another feature of the 19th century presidency that they had an enormous number of patronage positions to fill, you know, jobs that they could give out when they came into office to reward their party henchmen and so on. And about approximately 40 times as many of those positions as a modern president does. As a result, the president's job for the first few months of his administration consisted largely of seeing office seekers and interviewing, you know, people who had given a speech in Canton, Ohio or something. And so all these strangers had complete access. Our man, the man who ends up shooting Garfield, met him several times. He had an interview with him in the president's office, and at one point he went to a White House reception and kind of came up quietly behind Mrs. Garfield, Lucretia Garfield, and handed her his card and kind of whispered his name and spelled it out for her quietly so that she would remember it. Those were his words. And if you could think of anything that would catch the eye of the Secret Service, surely it would be somebody sneaking up behind the First Lady and spelling his name slowly. But the Lincoln assassination was considered a one-off, that it happened in the context of the Civil War, and that it just was something that wouldn't happen in America, because if you didn't like a president, you could just vote him out of office. It, well, he wasn't like a king or somebody that you were stuck with. And so nobody expected it to happen again. And in fact, even after the Garfield assassination, they didn't add security for the president even after two assassinations.
Right. And of course, we have the assassination of President McKinley then 20 years after this particular incident. I thought it was interesting that part of the story of the assassin was of a religious fervor that took hold of him, and which seems to have played at least some role in why his disappointment at not receiving what he thought he expected sort of took on such tragic overtones.
That's right. Charles Guiteau, it is impossible at this distance to diagnose his mental condition, but there can be little doubt that he was suffering from some mental disease. Our experts speculate that it was possibly paranoid schizophrenia. But in any case, he sincerely and earnestly believed that God was talking to him. And he was wildly deluded. You know, in fact, he was also very brilliant, but troubled and almost homeless by the time he shoots the president. But he thought that he did so explicitly to make Chester Arthur, who was the vice president, to put him in office. And then he thought that Arthur would be so grateful to him for shooting the president that he would make him, you know, Secretary of State or something, that Guiteau would be beloved and rewarded for this service to the country, which says something about the atmosphere of 19th century politics, that he would think that shooting the president would result in his elevation to high honor. But that it was really this, the voice of God, that he just sincerely believed to the end that God had spoken to him and wanted him to do this.
We see the moment of the assassination played out, and then, of course, the aftermath. And I think this is one thing that most Americans don't begin to appreciate, given the fact that the assassinations of Lincoln and McKinley and Kennedy played out so differently, with the death of the president following on the heels of the shooting so very quickly. In the case of this shooting, it was a much longer ordeal. Talk for a moment about the way in which this really shaped this into a very different sort of trauma than the other assassinations I just mentioned.
Well, the Guiteau shoots Garfield out of the blue. Garfield is walking through a train station. Guiteau comes up behind him, and he shoots him twice. One bullet just grazes his arm, and the other kind of goes into his back as Garfield is turning. And as Garfield is turning around to see what was behind him, and because he was turning, the bullet took a different trajectory within his body than the doctors expected. And so he's knocked down right away. You know, a dozen doctors show up, and the standard procedure at that time was to try and find the bullet to determine whether it had damaged his liver or something that would require critical, immediate, radical intervention. And they do this on the floor of the train station. It's incredible. This is really just the dawn of antisepsis. Is the idea of germ theory is really just dawning at this time, and the various people who examined Garfield at the train station clearly had no truck with germ theory. They're sticking fingers and probes into his back on the floor of the train station, and Garfield is then taken back to the White House, where he doesn't die immediately. In fact, he lingers for 80 days. At first, he seems to recover, and all the reports were that we've been spared the worst, and that the president will be back. And one doctor Dr. Willard Bliss, sees an opportunity to make his career, and he basically sidles out, forces out all the other doctors, so he's in sole control. And unfortunately for him, all the while, there's a massive infection building within the president's body that's been introduced probably almost immediately on the floor of the train station. If he'd been left alone, if he'd just been, bundled up and taken home, and he probably would have been fine. There were still lots of guys walking around with bullets in them from the Civil War, and that's probably how Garfield would have ended up. But he, unfortunately, had far too much medical care, and this rather rough probing for the bullet and the introduction of germs into his body was what killed him, not necessarily the assassin's bullet.
Right. In other words, the infection ultimately was the killer here, almost more so than the assassin's bullet, which, of course, caused the infection. But in a sense, it heightens our sense of tragedy because it makes the death of President Garfield, in a sense, unnecessary.
Absolutely, absolutely unnecessary. And it's so close. That there were doctors around who believed in antisepsis, and if they just cleaned the wound, they in fact there was a doctor came to the White House. Lucretia Garfield, knew somebody, a family friend, who was a homeopath who believed in, cleaning the wound and so on. And he tried to intervene, and he was not allowed to do so. And it would have been so easy to save his life. And and really, the course of our country's history might have been very different. Garfield, nobody was going to usher in an era of racial harmony in 1881. Things were too ugly for that. But things might have been less awful. What is kind of lightly called the Jim Crow era might have been somewhat less awful than it was had Garfield lived.
I want to mention that one thing I appreciate about the way these events we've been talking about are portrayed in your film is that there are all kinds of moments when we hear President Garfield, mortally wounded, screaming in pain. And that might seem like a very small detail, and yet I think it's a very telling one because, first of all, I don't think most of us imagine President Garfield screaming in pain as these doctors are working on him without any of the modern breakthroughs that would make that a completely different experience and at least somewhat without the agony that one experienced at this time and place. But I so appreciate your willingness to include that really bitter reality that was part of what President Garfield was experiencing.
Yeah, we were determined to make this as real as possible, and within some bounds. But it was a terribly painful and difficult ordeal, and there's just no getting around that. And I think that for me, the holy grail of history is to inhabit even a moment from another time. And part of that, in order to do that, of course, it's an elusive thing that we could never do. We would have to, learn everything about their present and past and unlearn their future. But we would also have to experience the web of emotional entanglements that is human, the human experience. And I think that the combination of recreations and narrated archival film is a very potent means of kind of getting us down that road a little bit within the span of 2 hours of kind of, we of course will never inhabit that time, but the narrative film technique allows us to jumpstart a set of emotional connections and feelings, and part of that is the rawness of that experience of real life. That that's what it looked like on the floor of that train station, and we tried to be as faithful to that as possible in order to have our audience come as close as possible to experiencing those moments in the summer of 1881.
Right. And, of course, not just the heartbreak of a whole nation, but with special acuteness, of course, the heartbreak of Mrs. Garfield losing her beloved husband. The film... Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that time and again we found that the Kennedy assassination was our touchstone. I'm too young to remember the event itself, but I certainly remember the reverberations. And was that a public or a private tragedy? Well, Jackie of course, the gist of the thing was that it was both, and that in a way Jackie stood in for all of us, that her mourning was all of ours, and her dignity was inspiring, and I think it was very much the same with Mrs. Garfield, that through her, she is us, she is us, and we mourn what might have been through her.
Hmm. The film again is called Murder of a President. It tells the story of James Garfield, of his assassination and the tragic aftermath, and tells the story of our country at this point in our history, the divisiveness in politics, that climate, which is probably one reason why this assassination occurred in the first place, and of course poses for us all kinds of intriguing questions, many of them ultimately unanswerable, about what might have been had President Garfield in fact lived. The film again called Murder of a President, airing tonight on PBS Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. And much more information about the film and the story is available on the PBS website. The director and producer, Rob Rapley. Rob Rapley, thank you so much for making such a marvelous film and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
And the time is 8:46. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We are going to be talking today on The Morning Show about resilience. It's a term which gets bandied about, but which most of us don't begin to really fully appreciate. And of course, what we're really talking about is not the resilience of stainless steel. We're talking about the resilience of the human heart, about the human soul, and about the capacity for human beings to be resilient even in the face of grave difficulties of one kind or another. The book at hand by Eric Rettens is called Resilience, Hard-Won Wisdom for Living a Better Life. And the author is someone who has tasted adversity and challenges of various kinds through his life. His experience as a U.S. Navy SEAL through several different deployments, a recipient of the Purple Heart and Bronze Star. He is also quite the scholar, with a Ph.D. from Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. Teaches as a senior fellow at the Truman School of Public Affairs at the University of Missouri and at the Olin School of Business at Washington University. He has several best-selling books to his credit, including The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL, and The Warrior's Heart, Becoming a Man of Compassion and Courage. One of the things he is best known for is for founding a great organization for veterans called The Mission Continues, which empowers veterans to make a positive difference in their own communities. And, of course, he has done tireless work on behalf of veterans to help them contend with the ravages of what they have experienced and in order to have the richest and most meaningful lives that they possibly can. And towards that end, this book has been written called Resilience. Eric Greitens, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Greg, so good to be on with you. Thanks very much for having me today.
This book, Resilience, is set up in a sense as a series of letters which you wrote to a former Navy SEAL comrade whom you call Zach Walker, although I'm pretty sure you actually change his name to ultimately protect his identity. Tell us more about him, because I think it's important to know the kind of stern stuff from which he was made, which helps put into proper perspective then the terrible difficulties which he faced once he was home from his deployment.
Yeah, Greg, so Zach was a tough kid from a Northern California logging family, and he went with me through BUDS, the Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Team Training. And even in a SEAL Team Training class, this guy was one of the toughest of the tough. After our training, he went off to Afghanistan, did a deployment, came home, sort of welcomed home as a war hero, bought a concrete pumper, started a concrete business, good father to his two young kids. And then what happened, Greg, is that his life was just hammered by hardship. His brother died. He lost his business. He drove his truck into his driveway one day, got out, dropped to the ground because he thought there was a sniper who was watching him. He laid there for hours, and then he got up and ran into his house, and he realized that he had post-traumatic stress disorder. And then what happened was that he started drinking, and Zach did nothing in moderation. So on the weekend, it wasn't a six-pack of beer, but a cooler full of beer that he'd be working through. And then he called me, actually, after he'd been arrested. So now my friend, who was once the Navy SEAL, war hero, small businessman, entrepreneur coming home, is now the unemployed alcoholic on disability who's looking at the prospect of having his kids come to visit him in jail. We talked that night as I was driving home, and then when I got home, I started writing him a letter about resilience, a letter about how you build this virtue that helps you to get better when things are hard. He wrote back to me, and the book is a series of 23 letters. It draws from my experience, it draws from a lot of ancient wisdom about how we can deal with pain and build wisdom, how you deal with fear and build courage, how you can move through suffering and actually become stronger on the other side.
If we looked at the actual letters that you wrote to Zach Walker, reaching out to him, trying to offer whatever help you could, I wonder what those letters would look like. I guess in some ways what I'm asking is ultimately how different were the actual letters you wrote to him versus what we see in this book, which of course for all kinds of understandable reasons are reshaped and edited and so on in a sense that's more appropriate for this kind of a book. But I'm just curious, what were those original letters like? How many roughly were there? And whatever you feel like sharing about them, I think would be really
sure.
Interesting.
Yeah, of course, Greg. You know, I mean, these letters actually are very close to the real letters that I wrote to Zach. Now, you know, a couple of differences, of course. You know, at the beginning of the letter, I'd give him an update on how I was doing, how Sheena was doing. I had a son just 8 months ago, and, you know, while we were writing these letters, I was giving him updates on expecting Joshua's arrival and then, you know, when Joshua came. And we'd talk a little bit about his kids. I'd ask him how his wife was doing. So a lot of that kind of, you know, personal back and forth, a little reminder of a SEAL buddy who I just talked to or somebody who he had talked to. You know, that stuff we shaped out of the letters. But really, these letters are pretty close to what I was writing to my friend because, you know, he really – this was a guy who was incredibly smart. Now, you know, had a high school education, and he would tell you himself didn't necessarily do great in high school. But like so many people in our culture, so wise, so thoughtful, and he really wanted to dig into – some of these ideas about how you build resilience, and it helped him to create a lot of clarity in his own thinking. So these letters are pretty close to the letters that I wrote to my buddy.
Hmm. I think one thing that's really interesting is that your book helps us sort of understand the whole notion of, well, for obviously resilience, but even before that, just kind of the notion of what philosophy is. Because, of course, the fact is, plenty of people who read your book, in fact, most of the people who read your book are not going to be PhDs from Oxford who can put Rhodes Scholar in their biography. I mean, I'm sure you hope that, in fact, a lot of so-called ordinary people in the sense of academic credentials will take this book in hand and make sense of it, even though, you know, at a glance, a lot of what you write about are matters of philosophy, which I think a lot of people think has nothing to do with them and nothing to do with their humdrum ordinary lives, if that's the way they look at their own life. And one of the things you say is that we all have a philosophy by which we live. and it's important to understand that. And it's also important to understand what the philosophy is by which you live your own life. And a lot of people never stop to even think about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you think back on what philosophy used to be, I mean, today when people think about philosophy, they think of people sitting and talking, right? Or maybe they think of people reading and thinking. But philosophy used to be a discipline of thinking and living. And the measure of whether or not something was a quality philosophy was whether or not it helped people to actually live a good life. And so, you know, philosophy is about hard work. It's about taking an honest and searching look at our lives. And that's always been difficult. People have always, in some ways, you know, resisted it, but good philosophy involves deliberately making yourself uncomfortable. It involves asking yourself a tough question about responsibility, for example. You know, are there excuses that I'm making in my life that are making me less resilient than I should be? How can I take control? How can I take responsibility for what's happening and what I'm doing so that I actually build resilience in my life? And you learn that ideas matter, and the way that we think about key virtues matters, even resilience itself. You know, a lot of times in our culture, when people think about resilience, they think about bouncing back. I mean, if you ask somebody, what does it mean to be resilient? They'll say, well, it means that you can bounce back, you can bounce back. But it turns out that that idea of resilience actually comes to us from physics. So in physics, there's this principle of elastic resilience. It's the measure of the ability of an object to return to its prior state after it's been hit by an outside force, especially compressive stress. And that's how people think about resilience in human life. But the fact is, human beings can't bounce back. And the reason why you can't bounce back is because you can't go back in time. So the 19-year-old kid who leaves for Afghanistan is never going to be 19 again. And parents who lose a child are never going to be the same parents again. An entrepreneur who loses a business is never going to be the same entrepreneur again. We all are affected by hardship and difficulty. And what resilient people are able to do is not to bounce back from hardship. They're able to integrate hard experiences into their lives in such a way that they become better. So we take some concepts like that. We talk about what it means to build virtues in your lives, and we put them together in a very practical way so that they could actually help my friend, and I hope will help anybody who reads this book to build resilience.
I especially appreciated that point you made about how we need to stop thinking about resilience as bouncing back, as returning to our original state. And I suppose one of the reasons it's good to think about that is because if one has that unreasonable expectation that's the ultimate goal, to bounce back, to become the person you used to be, then they are subject to great disappointment and disillusionment. But if you understand that really cannot be the goal, that should not be the goal, that in and itself is probably a very significant plus in whether or not someone is ultimately going to become resilient, if they understand what it means to be resilient.
That's exactly right, Greg, because a lot of times we actually hurt people when we tell them that they're supposed to bounce back. You know, think about somebody who has lived through a tragedy. Think about somebody who's lost a loved one, or even think about someone who's lost their job or who's lost a business. Like, when hard things happen to you, they are going to affect you and they are going to change you. And again, this is another idea that we kind of take from physics. And what we talk about in resilience is when hardship hits you, it doesn't hit you when you're at rest. We're always moving. We're always moving through time. So hardship is going to change your trajectory. And we have choices that we can make in our lives about what direction we actually move in and how we're changed by hardship. And what resilient people learn to do is that they learn how to take responsibility. They learn how to develop purpose in the face of pain. They learn how to tell stories about themselves. They learn how to create a sense of identity. They learn how to use mental toughness techniques to confront fear. All of these things we can draw from in order to actually get better in the face of hardship. And we do sometimes a real disservice to people and even harm when we tell them that they're supposed to find closure. I mean, think about what it's like to lose a child. Think about how hard that is. Like, you're never going to have closure with that. That's always going to be with you. And the question is, how does this affect you as you move forward? And how can you move through what's going to be genuinely hard in your life and create some sense of wisdom, some sense of purpose, some sense of strength?
The book is titled Resilience: Hard-Won Wisdom for Living a Better Life by Eric Gretens. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg from the Carthage College Political Science Department will offer their analysis of the Iowa caucuses and the presidential campaign thus far. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. Today will be cloudy, very windy, with a mix of rain and snow, possibly an inch of accumulation. Some wind gusts up to 30 miles an hour this afternoon, a high of 39 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake